Hello, and welcome to The Intersection. My name is Mark Riley, and I want to thank you so much for joining me on this episode of the podcast. Well, Joe Biden has made his choice for a running mate. Kamala Harris, and I'm sure most of you know who haven't been living under a rock, that she was the choice, and she makes a lot of sense on many different levels. I thought there might be a chance that he would make a political choice and decide to choose Val Demings, the congresswoman from Florida, because Florida was such a key swing state. No matter. The bottom line is, he made the choice for Kamala Harris, and I'll tell you why I think this really does make a lot of sense, and this is from a personal point of view. You know, I had a chance to meet Kamala Harris last year, briefly, while she was still running for president. And one of the skills I've honed over the years, and I'm talking about over a long time, is spotting a fake politician. And when I say fake politician, I'm talking about people who, when they start going down a receiving line or when they're in a crowd of people, they plaster a smile on their face. The smile doesn't move a millimeter until they're finished. And the people that they meet just become secondary to the fact that from their perspective, they're smiling and open, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And usually this happens, you get that smile, and then you move on to the next person, and the next person after that. The smile doesn't change one bit. Well, I was introduced to Senator Harris, and to be perfectly honest, brutally honest, I wasn't expecting a whole lot. After shaking hands, however, I told her my wife attended Howard University. Her face lit up like a Christmas tree. It was a look that a politician could not fake. She exclaimed, "Go Bison." I knew then that Kamala Harris was for real. One question, however, looms large now that she's part of the Biden-Harris ticket. How sexist will coverage of Senator Harris in fact be? Already we've seen Tucker Carlson, for example, impugn the integrity of war hero Senator Tammy Duckworth. And just beneath the surface of the vice presidential sweepstakes are a number of questions that are almost never asked of a man. Is she too ambitious? Does she rub people the wrong way? One would think in 2020, these kinds of questions would have gone the way of the horse and buggy. They have not. Valerie Jarrett, former advisor to President Obama, was one of a number of prominent women who sent a letter to media leaders reminding them of the double standard in too much of their coverage. Now, we should be clear about the fact the media is not the only entity that tends to stereotype women and tends to portray women in contexts that they would never, ever think about portraying a man. But before we get any further with that, let's talk about the latest situation facing Kamala Harris. And I don't really think it's facing her because the media, in this case, did its job and said that the claim was a lot of nonsense. Donald Trump jumps up and says Kamala Harris might not be eligible to run for president because her parents were immigrants, one from India, one from Jamaica. Now, anybody with half a grain of sense in their head know that because she was born in Oakland, California, she is by birth a citizen and therefore eligible. Donald Trump doesn't like birthright citizenship. Stephen Miller and some of the other minions that surround him don't like birthright citizenship, but it is now ensconced in the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. And whether they like it or not, it's a fact. So now they're starting to try and spread this based on an article or an op-ed that was in Newsweek magazine. I haven't read it. I suspect Donald Trump hasn't read it either, but somebody told him about it. And as he does so often, it's frightening how often he does this, he simply sits back and throws this bomb out that Kamala Harris might not be eligible to run for vice president. It's nonsense. It is absolute nonsense. And Trump's attempt, as he did during the birther controversy with Barack Obama, his attempt to try and throw some racist nonsense in the game isn't getting very far. We're getting down close to the election in November, And the more he tries to throw this stuff out, and by the way, and Joe Biden called him out on this, distract from his continuing ineptitude in handling the coronavirus pandemic, the worse it theoretically ought to get for him. Now, the idea that women, and in particular women of color, don't know their place when running for high office goes way, way back. In point of fact, it goes back to the early 1950s when a black woman ran for vice president on the Progressive Party ticket. I believe that ticket got something on the order of 140, 141,000 votes. And there's a very interesting codicil to that, but we'll leave it there. The bottom line is the historic presidential candidacy of the late Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm opened up fissures not just among Democratic politicians, not just among white politicians, but among black politicians and leaders as well. Because the idea was that she stepped out of line, quote, out of line, unquote, in making that run. And unfortunately, black elected officials and political leaders also attacked her, both publicly and behind closed doors. It was a tribute to Shirley Chisholm that she didn't care what anybody thought. Fast forward almost a half century, and there are a stunning number of qualified, experienced women from which Joe Biden chose Kamala Harris. There are also hundreds of women, in addition to Senator Harris, seeking elected office across the country. White women, black women, brown women, Asian women, the whole gamut. It's an unprecedented number. And if most of them win, and by the way, they run the gamut of political ideology, right down to one woman in Georgia who apparently subscribes to the QAnon theory. And I don't know if I'm pronouncing it rightly. But you'd think that with the numbers of women who are involved here, that there would be less sexist coverage. But there's no guarantee. Sexism, much like racism, is part of America's DNA. And I know that a lot of people don't want to admit that. A lot of people, you know, are backing the land of the free and home of the brave situation that we were told about as kids. But racism and sexism are part of America's DNA. Let's see how many descriptions of female office seekers across the country mention their clothes, their hair, their makeup, their demeanor. See, because nobody talks about Joe Biden's hair. Nobody talks about Joe Biden's demeanor. Or maybe they do, but they certainly don't in the same context as they did, for example, about Hillary Clinton. The Me Too movement, like Black Lives Matter, has moved some of these discussions about the sexist coverage of female office seekers directly center stage. The question I have is whether after the election of 2020, these issues will be driven to change or whether they'll recede to the background of American life, as they have so many times before. When we come back, more on Kamala Harris. Is she, quote, not black enough? How much of the negativity around Joe Biden's announcement of Kamala Harris as his pick, how much of that stuff is actually made in the good old USA, and how much of it is foreign born? This is The Intersection. Welcome back to The Intersection. My name is Mark Riley. Join the conversation on my Facebook page at Mark Riley Media. Back we go to Kamala Harris. Among the lowest criticisms leveled at her is the notion that she is somehow not African American. Keep in mind, she's a product of an Indian American mother and a Jamaican American father. The common point, of course, is American. Yet some people insist on labeling her according to their own definition of blackness. This ugliness has reared its head before. When Barack Obama began his quest for the presidency in 2007, there were black people who flooded social media, and social media was a lot less sophisticated at the time, with the notion that he wasn't black enough, that his experience wasn't the typical African-American experience. In short, that Barack Obama was somehow less black than the rest of us. All that changed after Obama began winning primaries in early 2008. Then some people went from not black enough to my brother. What I find strange in the latest round of the Who's African American sweepstakes is that it appears not all of it is generated by black folks in the U.S. I saw one article about this online that referenced a news website I had absolutely never heard of. A little later, I read an article that said there was evidence that articles of this type, and it was one of those situations on Facebook where somebody posted it, and it linked to an article that was from some, again, a website. I don't even remember what it was, but it wasn't one that I would have called immediately to mind. And when that happens, I have a tendency to try and dig back and find out a little bit more about this website. And to be honest with you, it was forgettable. So forgettable, in fact, I forgot which website it actually was. Now, The Washington Post recently spotlighted a guy down in Florida who has admitted to circulating material designed to pander, that is, to right-wing social media users, but also to collect names, email addresses, and other information to then sell to interested parties. No evidence yet that this guy is aiming disinformation at the Biden-Harris ticket, but it wouldn't surprise me one bit if he did. The guy's become a multimillionaire by taking disinformation, spreading it out to various and sundry lists, various and sundry social media platforms, getting the email information, names, addresses, or whatever back, and then taking those lists. In some cases, I saw one instance that was mentioned in the post where there were a list of, I think, 173,000 people that he sold for $2,500. 173,000 people, most of whom probably had no idea that by looking at this particular conspiracy nonsense, whatever it was, or right-wing disinformation, whatever it was, that their email addresses would be harvested and sold to the highest bidder. Now, there is money in lying. Let's be very, very clear about that. As Kamala's not black makes the rounds, people who see them ought to check very closely the so-called news websites that promote this garbage. And it is garbage. And as Facebook poster Rodney Diggs points out, Kamala Harris is blacker than the previous 45 vice presidents and blacker than 44 of the previous 45 presidents. We should also keep in mind that for the Republican, that the Republican ticket will have a tough time defining Biden and Harris along their typical negative lines. This will make eroding support for the ticket, and specifically for Kamala Harris, among black people, a key part of their strategy. And it also points out why it becomes so important for black people all over America, but in particular in swing states, particularly in the South, which has gone for Donald Trump hook, line, and sinker, although they should know better. It's going to be crucial for black people in these places, of course, every place else as well, but in these places, swing states, the Floridas, the Ohios, the Michigans, which have substantial numbers of black people, but don't always turn out substantial numbers of black people, didn't turn out substantial enough numbers in 2016 to win Hillary Clinton the presidency. This also becomes crucial because there have been recent reports that Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, met with Kanye West, the once and future presidential candidate, last weekend. Kanye says they were discussing a book on black empowerment. My guess is they were discussing ballot access. Picture the scenario. West may not be able to get on the ballot in many states, but a write-in campaign coupled with the mail-in balloting that's being delayed by a post office run by a Trump supporter could have an impact. Can't happen, you say? Who would vote for a bipolar rapper with mental health issues? Enough people to cost Biden and Harris the presidency? Be careful. Stranger things have actually happened. Finally, musicians like Neil Young, the Rolling Stones, the estate of Prince, have been trying to stop the Trump campaign from using their music at rallies. What's making it tough to prevail? We'll tell you very, very shortly. This is The Intersection.
Son reflejos, en el baile se convierte en espejos. Ahora goza como yo lo gozo, mueve como yo lo muevo. Olvida todo tu estrés y cuenta un, dos y tres. Mueve los pies. Maestra Inés dice que el mundo está al revés, que la salsa es simplemente el sol.
Welcome back. This is The Intersection. My name is Mark Riley, and thank you so much for sticking with us. Got something on your mind? Message me on Facebook at Mark Riley Media. Now, you know, I have always loved Neil Young's music. Back to when I was in high school and college, back in the Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young days. I used to get disparagingly called a hippie because I used to listen to Neil Young and Crazy Horse. And I especially loved Rockin' in the Free World, which has a kind of anthemic quality to it. And I love anthemic pieces of music, whether it be in R&B, hip-hop, classical, whatever. And Rockin' in the Free World was one of those songs. It was a protest song as well. At first, when Donald Trump began using it at his campaign kickoff in 2015, you're thinking like, whoa, Neil Young is down with Donald Trump? It continued, according to the New York Times, through the 2018 midterms, when Young wrote he couldn't stop Trump from using his music. I found this very, very curious, being somebody that thought I knew a little bit about the music business. I didn't think, with all the copyright laws on the books, that any politician could get away with using music without the owner's permission. Turns out I was wrong. Turns out artists don't really have a great deal of power to stop the use of their work. ASCAP and BMI, and for those of you who are unfamiliar with the music business, ASCAP and BMI are the two largest music licensing agencies. They clear public performance rights for millions of songs in exchange for a fee. They even have special rights, and I didn't even know this. They have special rights for political campaigns. Because Neil Young and another Trump campaign favorite, the Rolling Stones, were part of those deals, they apparently have no legal right to contest his use of their music. So too, and when I say so too, I'm saying people who have also contested include Rihanna, Elton John, Axl Rose, R.E.M., Adele, and the estates of Tom Petty and Prince. But apparently, because they get some kind of money from ASCAP and BMI for the use of their music, they cannot contest someone that they might vehemently disagree with politically from using their music. Now, we ought to think about this for a minute and ask ourselves, why would a politician want to use the music of somebody who is the complete antithesis of what they stand for? And in Donald Trump's case, you know, Rocking in the Free World, the Stones, whatever, that's not exactly his wheelhouse, you would think. And it may well be that Trump never even decided to use these songs. It may be somebody in his campaign said, hey, it might be a good idea to use Rocking in the Free World, a little Neil Young. It'll give Donald Trump the aura of being hip, as it were. Well, maybe. And then again, maybe not. And in retaliation, or at least to get some kind of clarity here, some artists are taking up the fight in court. Neil Young sued the Trump campaign over its use of Free World and another song, Devil's Sidewalk, at his rally in Tulsa in June. You know, the one that he said 12,000 people attended, but the Tulsa Fire Department put the number at 6,200. You remember that. He asked the court to order the campaign to stop using the songs, as well as asking for statutory damages. The Stones have also served notice that they'll sue if Trump uses their music again. Both ASCAP and BMI have said they will remove Stones and Young's music from their political license. This could, theoretically, all be moot. Why, you ask? Well, because there's a possibility that the COVID-19 pandemic has made it very, very difficult, if not impossible, to stage rallies where music like this would be played in the first place. And somehow Trump is apparently saying that he's going to be accepting the Republican nomination for re-election on the White House lawn or something. I can't imagine his people using Rockin' in the Free World. But it really is about, and this is why I think the musicians are so upset. Politicians do not do anything, I don't care what it is, in a vacuum, number one, and they don't do anything that they think would hurt their own brand. And I believe that Trump's use of rock songs, whether they be contemporary or from the 70s or whatever, he uses them because he believes that these pieces of music will bind the artist to his candidacy. Now, I don't know. I mean, I could be mistaken. I'm not sure if he's ever used his boy Kanye West's music, that which is not obscene, at one of his campaign rallies. I would find that to be very interesting, and a very interesting question in point of fact. But the reason that candidates do this, and the reason why Trump knows that Neil Young and the Stones don't want their music used at his rally. They know this already. So why does he keep doing it? Very, very simple. All right. He believes that using a song like Rockin' in the Free World, which is a song that's like, 40 some odd years old now? But people know who the artist is. And Rockin' in the Free World, in fact, binds Neil Young to Donald Trump. And Neil Young has no interest whatsoever in being bound to Donald Trump. As a matter of fact, I'm not sure there are all that many artists or musicians that have that interest. Now, there are some. I'm not going to name any of them because I just don't feel like naming any of them. But there are some musicians, some country music artists and others, who support Donald Trump. I'm assuming they have enough catalog that Trump could use their music to the exclusion of anybody that doesn't want that music, their music, used at his rallies. But Trump persists. And we have to ask ourselves why. Hey, The unauthorized use of copyrighted material in many cases has consequences the Trump campaign has yet to experience. If prominent musicians can, in fact, through the courts, stop political campaigns from using their music, it may not seem like a big deal. But if it wasn't a big deal, why would politicians bother? And by the way, it doesn't have to be Donald Trump. There are some musicians who consider themselves to be apolitical. They may not want a progressive candidate or even a moderate Democratic candidate to use their music because they simply don't consider themselves to be political. And that, to me, that is their right. I would not, if I was running for dog catcher, I wouldn't use anybody's music that I did not pre-clear. Say, hey, Neil, is it okay? You know, is it that difficult to do that? And why do they continue to do it? And why do they disrespect the artists like this? You know, I mean, ASCAP and BMI saying, well, okay, well, we'll pull the license. That's, to me, that's not good enough. There should be cease and desist letters that go out. And they should come not just from the artists, but from the licensing agencies as well. Say, look, these people, and there's a list, theoretically, these people don't want you using their music. Is that hard to understand? I don't know. It may not seem like a big deal, but politicians bother with it anyway. So to them, it is in fact a big deal. Thank you so much for listening. The executive producer of The Intersection is Ms. Kim Jack Riley. Till we meet again, please stay well.